cultivate our motivation and really bring to mind that there's absolutely no happiness to be found in samsara. There's the appearance of happiness. There's the happiness that what we call happiness, because it's a reduction of previous suffering. But there's no happiness that lasts long in cyclic existence. And we know that from our own experience. Because we've had all sorts of pleasures before, and all of them are gone. They're last night's dream, over, done, just some memories. But what we want is some kind of lasting happiness. So we should look for it in the right place. And among transient things that are under the power of afflictions and karma, that's not the right place to look for true happiness. So we look for it in nirvana, in enlightenment, in a state of mind that is completely free of afflictions, ignorance, the karma that causes rebirth. So we all say we want to be free, and none of us want to be controlled by others. And the real freedom is nirvana. When we aren't dominated and oppressed by ignorance, afflictions, and karma. So let's turn our spiritual aspirations to nirvana. But let's not be content with our own liberation alone. And remembering the kindness of all the sentient beings, let's aspire for their liberation as well. Because we can do lots of nice things this life to make them happy, but we can't stop their aging, sickness, and death. But if we're able to progress along the path ourselves, then we'll be able to lead them on the path so that they'll arrive at actual happiness, the happiness that comes from nirvana, from transforming the mind, the joy that comes from generating bodhicitta in the heart. And so let's set our aim on that kind of happiness and aspire for full enlightenment so that we can actualize the happiness of nirvana for each and every sentient being. So yesterday we talked about restraining the sense faculties, you know, and especially restraining the mind, the mental faculty, because it's the one that reacts so much to the external, to the five faculties that cognize external objects. And then we also talked about having mindfulness and checking awareness that, you know, is aware of what we're doing, why we're doing it, what's going on when we're standing and sitting and lying down and walking, and what's going on in our mind when we're doing various actions, and so on and so forth. OK. Okay. So this kind of checking awareness isn't an extreme kind of self consciousness. Yes, people are self-conscious. Like, oh, what am I doing? How do I look? You know, it's not like that. But it's more a calm introspective. Okay, what's happening in my body? What's happening in my mind? You know, what are the precepts I've taken? What, how do I want to be in this world? Why am I doing what I'm doing? You know, what am I doing? How am I doing it? Okay, so it's more checking in that way. It's not designed to make you all self-conscious and anxious. Okay, but I better clarify that in case somebody got the wrong idea. Okay, so then the Buddha goes on in the sutra on the fruits of the homeless life, and he says, and how is a monastic contented? Here a monastic is satisfied with a robe to protect his body, with alms to satisfy his stomach, and having accepted sufficient, he goes on his way. Just as a bird with wings flies hither and thither, burdened by nothing but its wings, so he is satisfied with a robe to protect his body, with alms to satisfy his stomach. In this way, sir, a monk, a monastic, is contented. Okay? That kind of sets out, you know, because being contented and satisfied, it's a form of happiness, isn't it? And we don't know much contentment and satisfaction. And our society encourages us to be discontent because that is the foundation of getting us to buy more stuff. And, you know, we need to buy more stuff to keep the economy going. Right? So, you know, the whole message that we get from society is we're not good enough, so we need to get something that we don't have. Or go somewhere we aren't, or do something we haven't done. We don't have what's good enough. Yeah. We're not, you know, everything about us is unsatisfactory, so we need whatever this product is that they're advertising. It used to be in advertising. Advertising used to be, if you need this kind of service, here is where you can come and get it. It was just advertising to inform people where certain services were provided. Now advertising is to create desires and wants that weren't there previously. And so it plays on telling us that we aren't good enough, we don't have enough, we aren't doing what's right. And so we need to spend more money to do, have, and be what they're advertising. Okay. So we grow up with so little real contentment, you know? And our minds is just, talk about habit patterns. It's just happening all the time. Whatever we have, it's like, I want more, I want better, more, better, more, better, more, better. It's endless, isn't it? Yeah? It's like, you know, we just stop for lunch and like, oh, the lasagna, I really like lasagna, but why didn't they put spinach in it? You know, it would have been better if they put spinach in it. Or, I had one piece, and I've just taken a few bites, but I want to eat it quickly so I can go back and get more before somebody else eats it. Yeah. So never content. Yeah. Whatever we have, even you get a new car, you go on a vacation, you get something you've always wanted. The mind always wants more. It always wants better. It gets a hit from getting whatever it was that we thought we wanted, but then very soon the impact of that hit is gone and we're back to more and better, more and better. And so this is how our whole life gets used. You know, we run around in this struggle for pleasure, in this struggle for happiness. Now, and this happens in relationships. I mean, we see people madly in love and then they're getting divorced and all this stuff. It's the same kind of mind. I want more and better, more and better. You know, oh, you were a nice partner for a while, but gee, you know, I'm feeling dissatisfied, so I want something more exciting or more this or less that or, you know, whatever it is. And so the mind just kind of looks around, another person, another job, another this, another that. You know, so no contentment at all. So a monastic life involves training ourselves to be content with what we have. So you start watching the mind that is always saying, oh, we have this, but can we get that one too? Can we have this too? Can I do that too? You know? And we just bring it right into the abbey. Yeah? We want, you know, let's arrange the room exactly like I like it. Yeah? And make sure we have, you know, juice in the afternoon, because I like juice in the afternoon. And let's, you know, get this and that and the other thing. So continually this dissatisfied mind. And so dissatisfaction itself is quite painful, isn't it? Yeah? I mean, it's a mental state that's really quite painful, quite difficult. And I know when I first met the Dharma, this was one of the things I was so grateful for, was that the teacher actually talked about dissatisfaction and was able to identify what it was that was plaguing me so much, because I didn't know what it was. You know, I had a good life, and it was like, why, you know, something's missing. But the Dharma was missing, of course. But it was also the dissatisfied mind of, you know, oh, that movie was good, but what's the next one? And we had a good time with these friends, but, you know, now that's over. What am I going to do now? Okay. So we just train the mind in satisfaction. Yeah? So satisfaction with a robe to wear. Yeah? Notice it didn't say 10 robes to wear. A robe to wear. You know, you need a change of clothes, but you keep it, the change, with the mind that I'm just keeping it temporarily. I'm actually sharing it with somebody else, or I'm going to give it to somebody else. Okay? So you content yourself with the robe you have. When your robe tears, you patch it. You don't just kind of, okay, let's go get a new one. Yeah? But you really use your robes until they really completely wear out. Yeah? So learning to be satisfied with the robes we have. You know, in a society that's very clothes conscious. Yeah. And so you'll find, you know, people get ordained and it's like, I want the color of my Dzogchen to match the color of my Zen, to match the color of my Shenda. You'll notice with me, none of the colors match. It's three different colors in maroon. But, you know, lots of people, oh, very nice, the colors match, this is very nice. Feel how soft this fabric is, you know. Oh, you want to offer me a robe? Get this kind of material, it's really soft. Yeah. And then shoes can become a big status symbol. You know, in the Tibetan community, shoes and your knapsack, you know. That's how you have your individuality. Now, so you want Nike shoes, which are forbidden at the Abbey. You want a nice watch. Yeah? Okay. You want a nice backpack to put your texts in or your whatever. Now, anything to distinguish ourselves so that we, you know, look at this nice thing that I have that our my friends can admire and think that I have something nice. Okay. And so we even do it even about our book covers, you know, even about the statues on our altar, or the cloth on our altar. Yeah, but let me have some possessions that others can admire, you know, or that I can admire. So not, you know, very little satisfaction. Okay, so training ourselves to be satisfied with the robe to protect our body. So to remember that the robe is designed to protect the body. It's not for good looks. Okay, it's not to attract people. It's to protect the body from heat, from cold, from bugs, from whatever. Okay, satisfied with alms to fill our stomach. So this is another training that we have at the Abbey in accepting only food that has been offered to us and not going to town when we feel like having something. Yeah? Because that's kind of the instinct in lay life, isn't it? You know, oh, it's 10 o'clock at night and I feel like having chocolate chip cookies. Well, let's just go to the store and get them. Yeah? We don't do that here. Yeah? We accept what's offered and, you know, and accept it gratefully. If people ask us what we would like, you know, or what we need, then we tell them. But we aren't demanding, and we don't, like, ask for the highest grade, elaborate this and that, that the people themselves can't even afford. Yeah, so we learn satisfaction in accepting the alms that are given to us, and really feeling gratitude towards the people who sustain our lives so kindly. Okay, we happen to eat very well here at this abbey. I try desperately to get people to simplify meals, and they don't listen to me. Maybe I'm not an authority figure at all. Yeah, because I've been to some other monasteries where the food is not as good, and some other monasteries where the food is even better. It's quite interesting in the Theravada tradition, they just, you know, accept, they don't cook themselves, so they accept, if they accept ingredients, then the lay people cook it. Otherwise, they accept the dishes, and so many times people, that, you know, everything gets blown out of proportion, and they have these huge, magnificent meals with all sorts of dishes, because everybody wants to offer food to the monastics. So, you know, it's a way for people to accumulate merit, but it sometimes is just quite incredible, the amount and quality and quantity of food they have. And then you have other places where the food is more simple, there's not so much variety and so on. So, you know, we want to have food that sustains our body. We eat a nice breakfast here. People feel the need for protein in the breakfast because they work hard physically, so they need something like that. But, you know, to try and be satisfied with whatever it is that's given to us, you know. And, okay, and then having accepted sufficient of the food, the monastic goes on his way. So, not hanging around, like, oh, you gave me a really good lunch yesterday, I'm going to want some more tomorrow. Okay, and I love this image here, just as a bird with wings flies hither and thither, unburdened by nothing but its wings. Okay? So Lama Yeshe's often used that image when he talks about how to die. He says it's like a bird that's sitting on a ship in the middle of the ocean. It just takes off and goes. Mm. And when the bird flies, there's no trail that's left behind. You know? It just goes. And when it jumps off that boat in the ocean, it doesn't look back like, oh, where did I come from? And I want that. And can I take it with? Or I don't want to leave it. Nothing. Just like a bird that jumps off and flies. So I think that the same kind of thing when we receive offerings from, you know, people who support us, just, you know, accept with kindness and then go on. Without looking back and clinging, without looking forward in expectation of what we're going to get that's more and better, okay, but really being unfettered. And what we're unfettered by is our own wants and cravings, because craving is painful and craving is very binding, you know. And we just had that whole discussion about authority figures. And we didn't get to the part about what are we wanting for authority figures, but it's an interesting thing to examine. Sometimes we want space, we want approval, we want what they have, we want recognition. Could be any number of things that we're wanting from authority figures. But that state of wanting itself is a painful state, isn't it? You know? When you want something and you're not getting it, miserable. Yeah. And so that's why, you know, when they talk about the origin of suffering, the second noble truth, craving is pinpointed. Because we're not only craving for sense pleasures, but we're craving for a body, we're craving for a life, we're craving for existence. And just that process of, you know, the sticky mind of attachment that's craving, it's painful. And we're not free. And so real freedom, in a Buddhist sense, is releasing the craving. We think of freedom as freedom to get what I want that's going to fulfill the craving. Yeah, I want my freedom so I can get what I want that fulfills the craving, without realizing that it's the craving that imprisons us, and that what really sets us free is releasing the craving. But it's true, isn't it? Yeah? I mean, most people have been in relationships that haven't gone well, and what's so painful in a relationship that doesn't go well? Craving and attachment. Huh?
You're not getting what you want.
Exactly. We're not getting what we want. That other person isn't doing what we want them to do, and they're not giving us what we want. They're not acknowledging us and appreciating us and telling us they love us, and they're not presenting the image that we want them to present, so that we can have a certain image in front of our friends. And, you know, all this dissatisfaction, just craving, demanding, expecting, you know, being attached to the other person, being something that they aren't, in order to give us what we want. Yeah? And if you look, you know, this is really the source of the conflict in so many relationships, one after the other after the other. Isn't it? Yeah? So the craving itself is what causes the pain. It's not the fact that the craving isn't fulfilled. It's the fact that we're craving, that we're attached, that we're wanting. And so we can see our own little records inside. I want respect. I want acknowledgement. I want appreciation. I want love. You know? So what do I need to get those? I need money. I need sex. I need a job. I need clothes. I need a certain kind of car. I need a certain kind of partner. I need. I want. I have to have. And it goes on and on and on. Yeah? So monastic training, really, you know, what we have is good enough. So yesterday, out there looking at the rooms, and I was with Tom Town, like, oh, these rooms are small. You know, he's going, you wanted them small. Yeah, I did. Because, you know, we learn to be content with small rooms because, you know, we're monastics, we shouldn't have a lot of stuff that, you know, that we have to cram into a big, you know, a room. And we should be content with little and content with a small room. You know, we don't need huge, enormous, luxurious whatevers. Yeah. In the Zen tradition, the novices sleep in the meditation hall for 5 or 6 years, where they have absolutely no privacy. So forget about my room's too small. You don't even have a room. You know, you have a place that's about maybe about this wide. Yeah. That's, you know, on either side and all around, or all the other people have a place that's that wide. You have a cupboard in front of you where you store your clothes, and you sleep and meditate in that same place. 5 or 6 years. Yeah. Where are you going to put all your stuff? Yeah. So it helps you divest yourself of possessions, and also of this concept that we have of my space. Yeah, have you noticed that? We have this idea, I need my space. You ever heard people say that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? I need my space. We had a discussion group during one EML on what do we mean by my space. Yeah? It's a very interesting concept to really look at. Yeah? I want my space. What do we want? Uh-huh. What is it we're trying to say? How do we get in that mental state that says, I want my space? And what do we do when we don't have space? So, you know, all of this is stuff for training for us. Okay. And the next paragraph says, okay, so this monastic's content with the wear, what they eat. Then he, equipped with this Aryan morality, with this Aryan restraint of the senses, with this Aryan contentment, finds a solitary lodging at the root of a forest tree, in a mountain cave or gorge, a charnel ground, a jungle thicket, or in the open air, or on a heap of straw. Then, having eaten after his return from the alms round, he sits down cross-legged, holding his body erect, and concentrates on keeping mindfulness established before him. Okay, so in the old days, at the time of the Buddha, like I said, they were wandering mendicants, and so after they received their food on the alms round, then there were plenty of parks and natural spaces, and they would just go there, and in India it's very hot all the time, so you don't have to worry about getting too cold, and you find a tree, and you sit down under a tree, and you meditate. Okay, and so after the Sangha became more settled and there started to be monasteries, then people started meditating indoors. You don't have such a problem with heat and cold and bugs that way. But then it's interesting how we meditate indoors, and then, like I was saying the other day, we have our own little mini empire around our meditation seat with all of our, you know, colored, you know, the cloth and that we like, and the color we like, and the cushion we like, and everything like that. Okay, so it's quite interesting. If we really had to sit out under trees, what would we do? You know,
sit. So,
yeah, all the bees, all the bugs, you know, the ants, and you know, sneezing because of the grass, and it's itchy, and it's too hot, and it's too cold, and everything. So we actually have it quite good. Mm-hmm. But it's really nice sometimes to meditate outdoors, you know, just to take your cushion or a mat or something and sit outdoors and meditate and really, you know, kind of experience the fresh air and so on. Okay, so that's how they lived in the ancient times. They would do that. Then in the evening, you know, some of the senior Sangha would give a talk, and then they would practice walking and sitting meditation, sleep for about 4 hours in the middle of the night. We can't do that, can we? Well, we can sleep for 4 hours in the middle of the night as long as we have 4 hours before and 4 hours after. Okay. But one thing that you do try and do when you're a monastic is, you know, find the right amount of sleep and not oversleep, and see if you can reduce the amount of sleep, not because sleeping is bad, but because our lifespan is only so long, and if we spend our life sleeping, then we have that much less time to do study and practice and so on. So, you know, nowadays in society, people just think that sleeping is the ultimate in happiness, isn't it? You know, you sleep late on Saturday, sleep late on Sunday. You're not even awake to enjoy it, but you think it's happiness. So it's an interesting thing to kind of work with your sleep and try and find, you know, what is a suitable amount of sleep that my body needs and my mind needs, and what is too much sleep where I'm indulging myself, where I wake up and I feel groggy afterwards. Because if we sleep too much, we do feel groggy, don't we? Yeah, if we don't sleep enough, often we're in a bad mood. So finding kind of the, you know, the right amount of sleep. Yeah, learning to be content with the bed that we have. Better again, more and better and more and better. And I want a double bed. I want a queen size bed. I want a king size bed. I want flannel sheets. I want this kind of quilt. I want that. I want that. Yeah, I want a little rug at the top in front of my bed, so when I come out of bed in the morning, my feet don't touch the cold floor, even though there's carpet already. You know, so we always want something, you know, and try and make our sleep very comfortable. And at the time of the Buddha, they just slept out in the open. The nuns weren't allowed to do that. The nuns had to stay together in a building, but the monks slept out in the open. And you heard in charnel grounds and all sorts of places like that. If you meditate in a charnel ground, then it reminds you of impermanence and death, and so it helps you focus a little bit better. Especially if you're afraid of ghosts and goblins, then you develop strong concentration as a protection from your fear of ghosts and goblins. And still, in the forest tradition in Thailand, that's something that sometimes really spurs people into developing samadhi. It's the only thing that relieves you of your fear of ghosts and wild animals and things like that. Okay, so I'm not saying that we should return and do that or squish ourselves and make our, you know, torture our body or something like that. But let's just find what's reasonable for us and not indulge the body. Yeah. And then also just learning to be accepting of the conditions we have without being demanding. Yeah. Because sometimes it's very easy for us to get into a demanding mode, and I've seen some Sangha members in other places that can be very demanding, and it's really unpleasant for everybody. It doesn't give a good visualization to people. Okay? Now, does that mean that you never say what you need in a certain situation? No, you know, if you're with somebody and they say, please tell me what you need, or please, you know, tell me this, that, or the other thing, then, you know, you're fine to do that. But, of course, with some kind of tact, so you're not saying, well, yeah, I really, you know, can I sleep in the master bedroom, and can you fill the jacuzzi for me, and, you know, by the way, how about a hot fudge sundae that I can eat in the bath, you know, in the jacuzzi, and, you know, on and on. Okay, so we try and be modest even when people say, please tell me what you need. Okay. Okay. It's 6 o'clock. Any questions so far? Yeah.
I have a question about contentment.
Mm-hmm.
And because contentment is something that I've really cultivated in my life, but sometimes I also question myself about when that crosses the line into lack of motivation, lack of ambition, or not so much, not like ambition, like mm-hmm. career ambition, but just like,
yeah,
getting things done.
Okay, so the question is, if you cultivate contentment, isn't there a danger that you fall into being kind of lackadaisical or lazy, or you lose motivation to get the things done that have to get done?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Somebody once asked me, you know, do Buddhists have ambition? Yeah. And I said, yeah, you know, we have ambition. We want to become arhats and bodhisattvas and Buddhas. We have that kind of ambition. But we're not going to, you know, kill people and step on them and criticize them and trash their reputation to fulfill our ambitions. Okay. So sometimes people get this idea that if you develop contentment, that, yeah, that you just sit there and, oh, yeah, whatever, you know, it's okay. As His Holiness puts it, if it's activities to benefit yourself, you should have very few. If there's activities to benefit others, you should have as many as possible. Okay? So, you know, if your motivation is one to be of benefit and service to others, then of course you want to get things done. Because you know that, you know, you're living in an interdependent world, and if you don't take care of things, then it's going to affect other people and they're going to be inconvenienced by it. You know? So if somebody's just content, oh yeah, the car doesn't work and the brakes don't work very well, and, you know, but that's okay and I'm content, then somebody else is going to drive the monastery car and the brakes aren't going to work, or the car's going to break down in the highway. Because the radiator, was it, what happened? You were driving, weren't you?
Oh, yeah. I don't know what happened. It stopped.
Yeah. And the car stopped. And, you know, so it's we don't get that kind of acceptance because we recognize that. That
radiator's in the shop right now, all right?
You're a job.
Took some time.
3 years.
Make sure you get the right guy to
work. So, you know, we still do because we realize that we're, you know, interdependent, you know, and we don't want to be flaky and have other people, you know, inconvenienced, and so we take care of the things that need to get taken care of so we don't make ourselves a burden on other people who are going to have to pick up after us. Okay? But we do that not with the motivation of, you know, I want to have the best for myself and something good for myself, but, you know, with an awareness of dependency and, you know, actually taking care of ourselves can be a way of helping others so that then they aren't inconvenienced. Okay. Other questions? Yeah.
Yes, if we're talking about like worldly things, pleasures, at what point can you tell the difference between your practice, between the point of just being a pleasure as opposed to like desire as opposed to devotion?
Okay. So you're kind of asking, is it possible to get attached to your Dharma practice? Mm-hmm. And so you're desiring just, you know, to sit on your meditation cushion. And it's not really that you have a lot of devotion, but it's just a pleasant experience to sit on your cushion. Well, most people find that while you do experience some pleasure on the cushion, it's hard work. Yeah? Isn't it? It's hard work. So maybe if somebody has single-pointed samadhi and they can just go into these jhanic states, you know, then it's possible to get really attached to the blissful experience. But for the rest of us, you know, enough usually comes up in our meditation that keeps us busy working on it. Sometimes we get this idea in Buddhism that unless we're miserable, our motivation is attachment and selfish. Okay, so kind of like, you know, if I really look forward to going on retreat or I really want to do some meditation or I'm really engaged in what I'm learning about or, you know, something like that, well, that's just selfish, that's attachment. Okay, in other words, if we like something, that's bad. You know, the only way to be truly selfless is to be in pain and suffering and misery and hate the situation and hang in there anyway. Okay, that's what our mind thinks. Yeah. Do you know where we got that? You know, this is our cultural model, isn't it? This is the religion that permeates our culture. And unless you are miserable with that crown of thorns, you are not truly selfless, you know, and there's some attachment. Buddhism does not have that view. Buddhism says we should be happy. Yeah, and there's nothing wrong with being happy. And especially if you enjoy your Dharma practice, that's wonderful. You're so fortunate, you know, because you enjoy doing virtuous activity. Why should virtue cause us misery and suffering? Virtue should bring this sense of delight in our mind. You know, wow, I get to train my mind in something good. Wow, I'm working on my anger and attachment. Wow, I have a clear visualization and I have much more faith and feeling of connection with the Buddha. This is fantastic. I'm so happy. That's great. You know, we're always second-guessing ourselves, saying, you know, I should be miserable. No, we should be happy. And enjoying your Dharma practice, there's nothing wrong with enjoying our Dharma practice. We should enjoy it. If we don't enjoy it, we're not going to be able to keep doing it, are we? Yeah? So.
I've wondered about that the idea of ambition when it comes to things like a retreat with limited number of seats, or, you know, a teaching where you sort of see people clamoring for it.
Yeah.
And so I kind of wondered how to frame that.
Okay, so you're wondering about ambition when it comes time for laying down your seat in the meditation hall and you want to sit in the front, or in teachings, people like climbing over each other to go get a good seat. You've been to Dharamsala. You haven't been to Dharamsala. Wow.
No, I've seen it in terms of like a retreat that has a limited number of seats, so people are hurrying to sign up for it.
Uh-huh.
And I've always felt like, well, I want to go on this, but I don't want to take someone's spot who also wants to.
Oh, okay. Okay, so this is a situation where there's a limited number of seats on the retreat and everybody's hurrying to sign up, but you don't want to sign up because you think that there might be somebody else who really wants the spot. I think it's fine. If you want to go on the retreat, sign up and go. You know? I think if there's a limited number of seats and you're not sure if you can go, then maybe wait until you're sure you can go so you don't take a seat that winds up being vacant at the end. But if you want to go, there's nothing wrong with signing up and going, you know. And if you're setting down your seats, you know, and there's a vacant seat somewhere in the hall before teachings, it's fine to go sit in it. Don't feel like we always have to sit in the back of the room, you know, or whatever. I tend to see the opposite. Instead of is people saying, you know, I want the best seat. And in Dharamsala, you know, we're all just jammed together. And, oh, sometimes people can really be quite quarrelsome over, you know, this is my seat, and I sat here yesterday, not your seat. You know, I want to see His Holiness, and I'm just looking at the pillar. Can you move? Yeah. So, in those kinds of situations, what I do is I just let somebody, I mean, because I've been there so long, I've seen His Holiness so much, I can sit behind a pillar, it doesn't bother me at all. As long as I can hear Him, I'm happy, I don't have to see Him. You know? But boy, sometimes you get people who are just, you know, and that's very, really unbecoming. That's not very nice. But then don't go to the other extreme and feel like, okay, you know, there's a seats in the front, but somebody else may want them, even though the talk starts in 5 minutes, and I'll sit in back. Because actually, from the speaker's side, they like having the front rows filled. And so if you don't sit in the front row, you know, because you're trying to be modest and nobody else is there, then sometimes it leaves the speaker feeling funny. Hmm? Yeah?
This is just... How do you spell that word, sampajana?
Sampajana. Let's see if I can give you the Pali. The Sanskrit is different.
That's Pali, because I just wanted to be able to look up those, read about those four characteristics.
Okay.
I'm not sure how they translated it.
Okay. But they're in Pali. Okay. In Pali, it's Sampajana. And in Sanskrit, I know there's an R after this P, Sampajana. I'm not sure if there's one every two ends. But okay. Anything else? Let me just read the part for tomorrow, because this part is talking about how you start to develop concentration, and concentration, you know, we've just finished covering ethics, now we're moving into concentration. And so it's talking about abandoning here the five hindrances. So I'll just read it and then we will go over it tomorrow. Abandoning worldly desires, he dwells with a mind free from worldly desires, and his mind is purified of them. Abandoning ill will and hatred, he dwells with a mind free from ill will and hatred, and his mind is purified from them. And mind purified of them, and he has compassionate love for the welfare of all living beings. Oh, I see. So they put dots, and so I'm trying to fill in, but they don't tell you where to stop. Okay, so abandoning ill will and hatred, he dwells with a mind free from ill will and hatred. And by compassionate love for the welfare of all beings, his mind is purified of ill will and hatred. Abandoning sloth and torpor, he dwells with a mind free from sloth and torpor. Perceiving light, mindful, and clearly aware, his mind is purified of sloth and torpor. Abandoning worry and flurry, sometimes it's translated as regret and restlessness, yeah. Okay, so worry and flurry, regret and restlessness. He dwells with a mind free from worry and flurry, and with an inwardly calm mind, his heart is purified of worry and flurry. Abandoning doubt, he dwells with doubt left behind, without uncertainty as to what things are wholesome. His mind is purified of doubt. Okay, so those are the five hindrances. So worldly desires, hate, you know, ill will and hate, sloth and torpor, regret and restlessness and doubt. Okay. So we'll go over those tomorrow and talk about the antidotes and then how to purify the mind from them.